Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk, a show dedicated to exploring all aspects of creating a great dental office, where the only dumb question is the question that's not asked. Here's Jim and Han.
Good evening, Jim Jarvis here, along with my co-host Han Tran. How are you, Han?
Good. I'm doing great, Jim. How's everybody? Welcome, and thank you for tuning in.
Absolutely. Welcome to episode number 4, HJT Design Radio Blog Straight Talk. Today's topic is the three important parts: your equipment, equipment supplier, your designer, and your architect. But obviously, before we get into today's show, today is a rather important day, one that we always remember being the anniversary of 9/11 and all the folks that were directly and indirectly affected by that. I guess the only thing you really can say is we just never forget. And then also, we're very cognizant of the folks that are in harm's way right now, dealing with the potential hurricanes that are about ready to hit in a couple locations, obviously down in the Carolinas and I believe also over in Hawaii. So we're thinking about you folks, and especially with the evacuation orders, you don't have to be listening right now. You can always catch the podcast, right, hon?
That's right.
Down
here in Florida, too, we're bracing for it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you don't never know where they're going to go. And I guess it just being a, you know, in the architectural business and dealing with construction and constructed buildings, there are just so many things that can be done and sometimes should be done in the way of protection for the built environment. And there's just a whole lot of discussion that can be done on construction techniques that can be utilized to really withstand these kind of storms and these kind of issues, so that you, the individuals that you know, live in these homes or work in these buildings aren't as vulnerable, and that actually probably could be utilized as a whole series of shows, as not as opposed to one. But one product that is just phenomenal is called an ICF. That's insulated concrete form, and that wall system. So if you have any interest in looking into alternate construction techniques for shelter buildings, ICF, and or give us a call and we'll talk about it. But it's a really interesting and extremely durable wall system, construction system, that can withstand and basically take Mother Nature and survive. Obviously, tonight's show, if you'd like to call in and ask us a question, please do so. You can get us at 657-383-1442. And we'd be glad to hear from you. You don't have to give your real name, and we'll hopefully be able to answer your question, or at least get an opportunity to hear what you have to say. Just a little factoid today, hon. I just could not believe it. About a year and a half ago, obviously, as I think I stated before, you know, I've got a almost 100-year-old home over here in northwestern Ohio in Perrysburg, and my garage has to have some restoration work done on it, and I need to put in new rafters in my garage. A year and a half ago, I priced them at basically $20 a piece to put in these 2x8 rafters. I just bought them today, and I'm going to have them delivered. And you know how much they cost now?
How much? I'm afraid to ask.
$30 a piece. So I've effectively, in 1.5 years, increased $10 on each individual piece of lumber. I mean, that's just a prime example of what's happening with the construction world out there, and specifically what's happening with the costs.
Jim, is there a factor that are responsible for the, you know, for such a high increase?
Yeah, all the contractors are telling me the reason for the high increase is obviously we went through many, many years of downturn economically. And so the upturn in the economy has really spurred on growth. And because of that growth, product is becoming limited and supply and demand is prevalent. So when product becomes limited, it's going to cost you more to get that same piece. So that same cost to put in a 2x8 a year and a half ago was $20. Now it's 30. And that's just for the material. That cost also goes into what happens with the construction labor. And that relates right down to the bottom line of what you're doing for the cost per square footage on your facility. And that's just one little piece of a building system. We're hearing the same thing over and over again for all the other components. So construction costs, be it a new construction or a renovation costs, are going up. And that hit home to me really hard because it came out of my pocketbook.
You're talking about it's a 2x8. Is there a, you're talking about rafters, so it's just a raw piece of lumber.
Yeah, just a raw piece of lumber.
Yeah, so it's not an engineer component.
Nothing special.
Like that, but
nothing special.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
It went from $20 to $30.
I was talking to a contractor who worked on one of our projects presently, and he said that he has subs that are so busy that they are not willing to commit the time to work on his projects. No way they can pick and choose because the demand for, you know, the supply of labor is also short. So those that are providing labor for construction projects also can pick and choose the size, the quality, the duration, and cost. And so it definitely is going to affect a lot of projects, especially small projects, where, you know, if you are in an area of the country or in the community where you are surrounded by hospitals and schools and university and things like that, you know, things that we don't think about is that if you have, let's say you want to have lockers in your new facility, your new building, those who schools would get high priority to the demand for lockers before you can. Okay. So, I mean, certainly there's, we're talking about specifying from, you know, well-known large manufacturer. I'm not talking about going on eBay and trying to find something that's sitting on the shelf in China somewhere ready to be shipped.
Right.
But you're competing, you know, if you're working through or buying through conventional means, you have just serious competition and material as well as labor. So it's looking like it's going to cost you more to do a project that you plan a year ago, and did not plan for the price increase in labor and cost. It could put a damper on your plan. But that's
exactly
that's a big jump, Jim.
Oh, it is a big jump. And every contractor that I talk with is telling me that they don't see an end in sight. Some of them are booked up for 2 years. So,
which is great
I guess
news.
The moral, yeah, well, it's good news and it's bad news. It's good news for the economy and the business and the GDP of our country, but it's also bad news for the individual, the dentist who wants to start a project. I guess the moral of the story would be, if you're thinking about it, don't wait. Get in line and get things tied down early, because right now no one is seeing an end in sight in the potential increases and such. And that kind of segues a little bit into tonight's topic and discussion of the three components, the equipment supplier, the dental designer, and the architect, who does what. It's kind of a scenario. What? Let's talk about the equipment supplier, Han. A lot of times that's the very first person or entity that a dentist is going to talk to about a potential project.
Yeah, let's say the scenario is the doctor has been in practice for a few years and he's thinking about doing a brand new building because, you know, he's just kind of ripping at the seam with growth. The first person naturally that have his ears will be the supplier, whether it's just normal everyday disposable supplies, but they're most of your supplier connect to, they have their counterpart, the equipment guys. So those are the guys that you guys and gal that usually get to come to the table first. They play an important role in the whole process because you have to identify the kind of equipment that you're going to use, whether you're going to use the existing or you're going to, change out and do something different. They do play an important component, but that component should be more focused around equipment. With the equipment selections and all that information that they can provide to the rest of the design team would help to help to streamline the design process. It saves a lot of heartburns. They are specialists in dealing with equipment. They know the manufacturer and they're seasoned enough to know how everything is connected, how everything should be mounted, and things like that. So they're great at that piece of equation for the project. They're probably, in my opinion, and Jim as well, we run into more often than we wanted to remember, is that they're probably not the individual that should be charged with designing a building or designing a space. They all say they provide free design, and I would caution you is that ask them to define exactly what is design. Because a lot of us, when we listen to the term design, we think of, they're going to lay out everything, call out everything, select it, all the finishes and all the detail, all the section, and then they give you a package that you can take it to the city and you submit for permit and everything is happy,
doesn't work that way, Han.
No, it does not work that way. That is the rude discovery when after you sign the contract to buy equipment, you get a package of tell you where all the pieces and parts would pertain to equipment is going to go with a couple of sheets of telling you what generic detail of what they want, in the wall to support an x-ray unit. And a pan unit and all that, but those type of information are purely reference information for the rest of the design team.
And you hit it exactly right, the design team. And folks, you know, go back to last week's episode, I believe, where we did talk about the design team. The equipment supplier is key. They are one of the core members of the design team. But I believe, as Han is stating, they're not the ones that should lead the design effort. Correct, Han?
And just to prove my point, if somebody designed a building for you or an office suite for you, there on their drawing document, there should be no disclaimer, none whatsoever. Okay, if you find this disclaimer, that just simply means that they say, I give you this, but I'm not responsible for it. I am not going to be responsible for the consequences resulting from you using it. Or some of the things I heard is, give this to the architect, and the architect will take the responsibility for the things that we have designed, which is, in my opinion, that just stinks. Why would you do something?
It doesn't work that way. As an architect, we don't do that.
Yeah, nobody in their right mind would assume somebody else's liability.
Well, okay. Exactly. I mean, what dentist would assume the responsibility of somebody else's work, and then take it on and basically say, okay, well, I'll take care of that or I'll fix it. You wouldn't do that in the dental practice, and we can't and won't do that in the architectural design practice, because it's actually against the law for us. We could theoretically lose our licensure because of that. So with that, obviously the equipment supplier is a key member. We're not saying that they're not. They're a very key member. We're just saying that they shouldn't lead the effort of designing your facility. And this could be a design for a renovation. This could be a design for a new build. It could be an addition, but they're part of. So really, let's segue right into the discussion of the dental designer. Now, Han's our senior dental designer. He's got many, many years of experience behind that. So he's obviously going to be the best person to ask what that role is. And I'm going to ask you the first and always obvious question. What's a blocking diagram?
I think when you hear the term blocking diagram, for the layman, it's just something. For the design professionals, a blocking diagram is usually similar to a bubble diagram. Which is blocking diagram is a term that I do believe is used mainly in the interior design community. It just simply means that you take a block, whether it's a shape of a circle, elliptical, a square, but a shape, some type of a shape, and it represents an area. Let's say the waiting room. So you have a shape that represents the waiting room. And you say, I need a couple of toilet rooms. So you got another, let's say, a couple of squares that represent the toilet room. So you basically got a bunch of little shapes that you move around, you place them, and it forms some type of a diagram of what your facility may look like. It's very much like a Lego, you know, like playing with Lego sets. So you have pieces that represent rooms and space and so like that, and you place it in some logical order to give you an idea what and how the a space, an existing retail space, may work out, in terms of how many operatories and so on. So blocking diagram, bubble diagram serves similar purposes. It's very schematic. It gives you a general idea whether it may or may not work. If you have a shopping list of, let's say, 7 operatory, and you need you have 2 toilet rooms, you have one in your private office, you want a private office, a council room, And so you have a shopping list of all of the space that you need. And you take all that and you put it into, you know, into the square or rectangle of a box that you're going to lease. And that should give you, you know, an idea whether it's going to work or not.
And really,
very, very conceptual.
It has to do with adjacencies, right? So it's how the function,
pretty much.
How each room functions and is adjacent to each other. For example, let's say you have your lobby, and it has to have a direct relationship to your front reception desk, but also has to have a direct relationship to a restroom. And so these adjacencies, that's basically how you figure out the adjacencies of the particular spaces as we begin the design process. It really doesn't create a floor plan.
No. Here's some of the things that I would caution is that, of course, again, it depends on the level of experience the individual putting a blocking diagram or a bubble diagram have when they put it together. Their understanding of how importance and priority of space, how they interact with each other. Because you can take a box of shapes and you can shove it into a rectangle and say it fit. But I think the big question is, will it work? That's the more important priority or objective. If it fit and it doesn't work, then it's worthless. So when you put together a blocking diagram or a bubble diagram, it have to convey the relationship between the space, the circulations to those spaces. It's very conceptual. So it lacks a lot of detail that are needed to answer a lot of the questions.
That's actually the next step. The next step is once you've got the adjacencies worked out, you've got the number and quantities of particular spaces, then you begin the actual design process.
Yes, then the design. We do what we call the feasibility study. It has more detail. So you know which way, how the circulation pattern really works. We even rough out, furniture and work counter and stuff like that, so you can actually see how each space actually functions. Let me step back a little bit on the blocking diagram and bubble diagram and all that. Because it's so conceptual, typically I don't see it being done. What I've seen when I critique the diagrams is that I don't see the code analysis done, which is really important for us, is that when we do a feasibility study, we already have done the code analysis, now, which is involved in building codes and accessibility code. The code, what makes that important is that it tells you all the things that you must have that's required by law or by state code. You take that into put that into a design, and then everything else is net usable space. If you don't have all the things that associate with the code included in the design from the start, you can create a lot of problems. And I find that this is why I say the equipment people are not your ideal people that start on the design process, because in their disclaimer, they actually told you they have not done the code analysis and they have not done anything that's associated with zoning. So already you have two red flags. Because if the design work, or even if it's preliminary, if the preliminary layout is not done take into consideration of the code, it could create a lot of mess for you. You take a layout that's done by a supplier, and you go, hey, I got seven operatories that I need. I got a couple of bathrooms. I got a nice, decent-sized waiting room, all that stuff. Okay, I'm ready to sign the lease somewhere. And then you discover that the code requires to have a certain certain requirements, say for instance, the corridor with need to be wider, the door need to be wider because it doesn't meet code, the bathroom need to be enlarged because it doesn't meet code. Suddenly you realize that your lease space that had everything that had been accounted for, that was laid out, no longer work for you. You could be in a world of hurt. Okay, so blocking diagram, bubble diagram, and even layout done by supplier need a different level of detail, and you need to know all that before you sign the lease.
Okay. Absolutely. So, yep. In our process, it's adamant that the information that is received from the equipment supplier is integrated into the design, but actually the design process is more predicated upon the functionality of how the dentist wants to work, what they want to do within their space, how they want to function from operatories, how the sterilization, how the equipment room, how the patient flow works, all of that is integrated in. On top of that, you integrate the code issues, the American with Disabilities Act, known as ADA, having to do with the laws and regulations of the land that require certain things to be of certain sizes and accessibility and those kind of things. Everything from the fact of whether you need to have a drinking fountain, whether you have to have a slop sink, whether you have to have a particular style of exit, meaning, you know, certain exit hardware, all that kind of stuff. Actually, the number of exits, for example, based upon the size of your facility, the length of exit, meaning the distance that you have to go from point A to point B to get out of the building, all of that is integrated in your design process from the beginning. Correct?
Now, yeah. Here's one thing that I see in era of design, and but unfortunately, it get passed through code review a lot. Say you have a space and it's only two public toilet rooms. And I've seen this all the time. And the question they always ask me is, why do we have to have it here versus there? If you're required to have two toilet rooms, they both have to be ADA compliant, both of them. And they both have to be fully accessible by the public, that they're public bathrooms. And the term public, that includes the employees. So you, as the occupant of that office, are also considered public. So those bathrooms, you cannot have, if you're required to have both of them accessible to the public, you can't take one and stuff it in your break room and say, well, I got two toilet rooms. No, if you do that, then you actually only have one public toilet room. Code say that the public cannot go through a room such as a break room to go to the bathroom that should have been made accessible to the public.
And that would hold true also for a bathroom or a restroom located off the doctor's office.
Yes. The doctor's office, if you have a private toilet room, that would have to be a private restroom. It cannot be used by the public. Okay, and often
so that's above and beyond in the count is what you're saying.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. And often though, you see more and more across the country that even though it is a private bathroom for the doctor, it often required to be ADA adaptable. What that means is that you don't see a grab bar, but if you need to throw a grab bar on there, you can, and it will be just like any other handicapped toilet room. It's ginormous in your office, and you go like, I don't need it that much, but anyway, the codes say it has to be ADA adaptable or ADA compliant. And once in a while, because you can, if you can convince the code official that it is strictly used by you, the owner, and nobody else have access to it, it's not available for anyone, they may allow you to make it a non-ADA restroom. So it you know, it'd be smaller. But that is also an important question to ask when you actually start to do the design work. You have to know all of the parameter, all the requirements. Like Jim said earlier, is that do you need to have a drinking fountain? Most of the time, the answer is yes. Do you need to have a mop sink? Most of the time, yes. And people go, well, I don't, you know, I have carpet. It don't matter. Whether you have carpet or you have stone, you have, it, the code say, you must provide, you provide. Because the next guy that you sell the building to can say, I don't like carpeting and rip it out, and he still got a mop sink that he used to mop his floor. So there's a lot of things that you have to know before you embark into the design stuff, because it's really rude to find out that after you're done and everything is good, and then you have to find extra space to squeeze in all the things that are required by code. I hate that.
Yeah. Well, also one area that we haven't really talked about is the, obviously we're talking about the internal adjacencies of spaces and how they function together, but there's also external adjacencies and how things should be placed and located through and around your building in the relationship to the outside environment. For example,
that's important too.
Well, it's very important. And one big example is that we always like to, if at all possible, place operatories with windows that face the north. And the reason why is because north light is the most unobtrusive, least glare sunlight that you can get, but at the same time you have the ability to see out and such. Placing operatories to the west is probably the worst, only because the sun is always low on the horizon. It's shining straight in. 90% of the time, your windows are going to be having the shades closed. Placing operatories to the east, you get that morning sun, which does the exact same thing. It's not as bad, but it's still there. And place operatories to the south, you're pretty much guaranteed to have sun almost, you know, a large portion of the day. So, you know, in this hemisphere, that's the way you have to accomplish at least the placing of operatories. And that holds true in a lot of other things having to do for entries, for example, entries in your building. The worst place to put your entry door is on the north face of the northwest face of the building, because that's where the major storms, winter storms particularly, come from. And so you've got that cold, blustery, rainy, snowy weather if you're up north, and that kind of blows right into your building. So it's the worst place to put it. You'd better have a better opportunity to put your entry on the east or the south, preferably the southeast portion of the building, which gives you the ability to up here in the north, if you have snow and ice, you get that solar effect, which actually melts that off faster. So there's a lot of outside environment issues that relate to how you configure a space and a building.
No,
and we Jim, tie that all together.
Because, Jim, we're talking about the entry of the you know, of your suite. Would you advocate for having a vestibule as part of your design?
Absolutely. That's another whole aspect that we haven't even talked about. A vestibule is crucial. And you say, well, wait a minute. I've gone into so many buildings that don't have a vestibule. Well, that's true. You have. And there's a lot of retail centers, especially the retail shopping kind of center, that you walk right up, walk in the door, walk right into the space. The problem is, you're not a retail center. A dental office is not a retail space. You're not a mercantile space. You are a service provider. So you begin the impression on your potential new patient and existing patients the minute they walk in the door. And so once they walked in the door and experienced your space and then sit down in the lobby, and the next person walks in the door, and all of a sudden they either get blasted by a cold rush of air because it's cold and windy outside, or they get blasted by a humongous burst of hot air because it's hot and humid outside, all of a sudden their perception of you and your space just went south, literally. Vestibules damper that and actually provide that buffer that allows you to have a lock, an airlock between the outside and the inside. So if it's air conditioned inside and you're trying to keep out the hot, humid air from outside, that's the best way to do it. Yeah, it's more real estate. You know, you're talking about, you know, a bunch of square footage for a vestibule and some money for another set of doors, but it's money well spent from the perception.
Yeah, it typically about 35 square feet. That's all you need. Typically.
Doesn't code say you have to have the doors basically about 7 feet apart?
Well, you got, you know, you need to be roughly about 5 feet wide, so that way you can fully turn around in a wheelchair. And the door is usually placed 7 feet apart because you need 4 feet minimum from the leading edge of the door to the next door. In other words, when you open the interior door, at the edge of the door, the distance from the edge of the door to the door in front of you that you're approaching to, the outside door, should be about 4 feet. So if you round it up, that's approximately a 5 by 7 foot space. That 35 square feet of space will pay for itself multiple folds. It's certainly worth its weight in gold.
Especially from the energy savings. I mean, just your energy savings alone over a few years is going to make up that difference.
Yeah, and it don't, no matter what part of the country you're from, okay, it don't have to be in the snow belt because it's, again, when you're in the cold weather, you open that door, all the heat within that adjacent space, your waiting room will rush out. And in places where it's really warm, like Florida and Arizona and Texas, well, when you open the door, all the cold air rushes out. And now your equipment now have to work, kick on, and replenish and temper that space again. So just think of every time you open the door, money runs out. That's why we have the vestibule.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, so, you know, to create the design space in the dental design side, you take all the information from your equipment supplier, integrate it with the adjacency issues, integrate it with the needs of the doctor as to what they're trying to accomplish from their program, integrate that on top of the requirements from the local agencies, the governmental agencies like the handicap code, specifically the local zoning codes and the local building codes. You kind of integrate that all together and come up with a design, particularly as we do it. We like to create, obviously, a floor plan, which gives you all the layout of what the size is in the space and that kind of stuff. A lot of times we do it in three dimensions so that you can visually see it and be able to get a better opportunity to realize just how this is going to work. And then also integrate that into what a site plan might look like. You know, a site plan is your property, which will show you where you can, you have curb cuts coming off the road. If you're doing a new build or if you're doing a renovation, parking lot, where your parking spaces are, landscaping, where your signage is going to be, all those other issues that are also predicated by code and zoning ordinances and your building setbacks. And then that just starts off the process, doesn't it, Han?
Yeah, I think a lot of time I see whether you are, you know, expanding it, you know, if you bought a building and you're ready to expand, just a simple expansion need to be thought out thoroughly, not just simply I want to add a couple a couple of operatories, because when you add onto the building, it affects not just the circulation, it affects whether in fact right now we're working on Dr. Hunsinger's building expansion, and luckily the expansion will not encroach onto the setback, because if you encroach on a setback, you cannot expand into that, you know, into that space. So just a simple expansion, you have to look at how the building, you know, or how the site can be affected. When it comes to site design, it's become more important if you're buying a raw piece of land. It's not about just simply plunk a building down. Often you want to design a building around the site, not simply design a building and then drop it onto a site. Am I correct on that, Jim?
Oh, absolutely. It is adamant that you have to design your building basically for three different levels at the same time. You have to design for the internal adjacency. You have to design for the aesthetics of the facility around what the doctor is trying to accomplish. And then you have to design for the site location and environment around you. So you've got to pull all this together all at the same time to make a solution that actually works. Obviously, if you've got a question out there, please feel free, give us a call at 657-383-1442. We'd be glad to answer that particular question. And I think it's a good time now to jump into the next of the three players that we have out there, and that's the architect. The architect, way back when.
You want me to ask the question, Jim? Let me ask you the question.
Yeah.
Okay. Jim, does the architect do blueprints?
No, the architect doesn't do blueprints. That's just one of the many things that the architect creates in what we actually do as a profession. Back in ancient times, there was a profession known as the master architect. That individual was the person or persons, more than likely, was the individual who started the project, oversee every nuance of every aspect of that building. For example, let's say you're building a pyramid. You would have a master architect who would literally oversee every nuance of what was being done and direct every aspect of that. And most often than not, you had one project for your whole life. That was back during the ancient times. The profession of architecture has actually changed greatly since then. Now, the architect is really the individual that's responsible for I like to call him the conductor of this sympathy of putting together a building and a project. You know, we pull together all the team players, we take this design concept that's been created from your dental designer, Han's work. We refine it, integrate it into something that can be physically built, utilizing all the construction techniques that are available out there and reviewing all that. We integrate what the engineers meaning the structural engineer, the mechanical engineer, the plumbing engineer, and the electrical engineer, who do their particular disciplines. We integrate all of their aspects into this set of documents to the point of creating what Han asked is creating what's called a blueprint, which is actually called better known as construction documents. These construction documents are then something that's used for getting your building plans approved from the building department, getting you a building permit, and then getting you a contractor who can send those out to bidders who then bid on your project and actually build from that set of drawings. That, in a nutshell, is a quick synopsis of what an architect does. If you'd like to get a more in-depth review, feel free to go to our website at www.hjtdesign.com and download our construction guide. And there's a thorough step-by-step review of everything that an architect does. And I'd also like to point out that if you either want to go to the trouble of Googling an AIA document, that's American International Architects document, and that's an AIA document number B as in boy 101. And that's actually a contract that is put together by the American Institute of Architects. And you will see in that line by line, item by item, point by point discussion on what the responsibilities and services that an architect should provide you. It's a pretty thorough document. I mean, the whole document is, I've got one here in front of me. It's actually 18 pages long. It also outlines what the owner is responsible to do, and it outlines what the contractor is responsible to do. It's a real thorough document and also been tested in the court of law numerous times. So it's actually something quite useful if you're looking at trying to or looking forward to doing a built project. If someone tells you that they don't want to utilize that particular document when they want to sign a contract, I guess I'd be wary and kind of be forewarned, because then that leads the opportunity for maybe you not to get all the services that you should be getting and what you are paying for. And it's a lot messier. But the construction documents obviously is the culmination of all this design work that we're talking about. And through the particular steps, for example, schematic design, we're going to go through and check out systems. We're going to go through and check out and identify the beginning of the materials, spatial relationships. Then once we've got that further defined, we'll go into what's called design development, where we'll answer all the questions. You're going to say, we're going to have this kind of floor in this room. The operatory is going to have this kind of floor. It's going to have these walls, these ceilings. These kind of windows are going to be utilized within the space. All this is called out. And it's a very, very thorough listing in both a drawing form along with a written form known as a specification that, again, helps to define the design concept and produce something that the contractor could then turn that into reality. So we'll tell them how big to make these rooms, where that toilet fixture goes, where that faucet has to sit, where the light fixture is going to be placed, at what height. And there are a lot of requirements, some code, some not code, that allow for or tell us where things need to be and how they need to be accomplished. And then none of that comes from, Han, you had related before, that you can't take a equipment designer's floor plan and go get a permit around it, because it's just not enough information. We in the architectural profession are actually required by law to have licensure. Our licensure is based around our knowledge and expertise having to do with life safety, because the buildings that we create in our design that are actually built around our designs are to be occupied by the public. And because of that, there's a whole criteria that's necessary utilizing codes, and codes differ from locale to locale all over the country and actually all over the world. So there's many codes that we have to deal with, but the practice of architecture, you must have a licensed architect to be part of. And another thing that we definitely recommend is, no matter who you use, if you don't use us or use someone else, is definitely get an architect as part of your team that has professional liability insurance. Most people don't understand what that's for, but it's actually there to protect you, the client. It's there for, in the rare occasion, if the architect makes an error, that you have some way to collect financially to augment what that error has cost you. And thankfully, knock on wood, in my 30 plus years, I've never had a claim. So you always want to ask if any potential architect you're looking at hiring, it's fair. It's fair game to ask them, have you ever had a professional liability insurance claim? Kind of the same kind of liability insurance that you as a doctor have, we as architects have to have, because we're dealing with the life and the safety of the public and the people that are out there. Now, on top of all this wonderful technical stuff that we do, we also like to create things that are aesthetically pleasing and attractive to the eye, because especially in the dental world, we understand that if, you know, you've got patients that are coming in and they're already anxious, few and far between like to go to the dentist, right, Han?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, it's not a high end. What do we want to do this weekend? You know, what do we want to do this weekend? Well, let's go to the dentist. No.
That's right.
So you've
let's
already
do it
got.
Twice.
Yeah, exactly. You've already got a patient that is anxious. So there are ways that we can help reduce that anxiety by the actual built environment and what we do and how we create things having to do with color and light and texture and sound. And all of that is integrated into the design aspect, both from Han's side and from my side, as we work together as a team. I guess that's also one of the great advantages of having us together, along with, you know, Dr. Hunsinger, as we create solutions for our particular clients. But then the last thing that we do as part of the normal basic services of an architect is help during the construction bidding as well as the construction administration. So while the contractor is actually out there building things, we do what's called observations to make sure that the quality of the project and the inherent aspect of what we designed is being accomplished. And we do that on a periodic basis. We're basically your eyes and your ears. And we answer questions. We help the construction process. We do things like review shop drawings to make sure that they're putting the right pieces and parts into the project. All of that is all verified to the point where you then have what they would provide is a occupancy permit from the local agency so that you can get an opportunity to move in and move forward with your design. But in, you know, a 10-minute nutshell, that's really what the role of an architect is and what you should expect from them. Now, one thing I'd like to leave you with is those blueprints that Han talked about, they're not yours. As the client, you don't pay to keep those. The blueprints or the construction documents are actually instruments of our creation and our design. They're actually owned by the architect and will always be owned by the architect. So, for example, if you were a individual, a dentist who wanted to make maybe say do 3 or 4 dental facilities and you wanted them all the same, You can't just take one set of documents from building A and build building B, C, D, E, and F. That's not how it works. So our specific documents, our construction documents, are actually specific to the individual project. And even though they may be exact duplicates, they're, unless you're specifically given the right and pay the appropriate commissions necessary, you can't use them over and over and over again. They're project one specific.
Prime example on that, Jim. In my past life, I work on projects for a client that own franchise. Okay, so it could be, let's say, a restaurant like McDonald's. The franchise owner may own five different locations. Each location may have the exact same building, but that building, that design can only, it had to be paid for, maybe a smaller compensation, but paid for and fit into the site. It handled like a complete different project with a totally different building, even though the building is exactly the same. Most of the time, the design had to be tweaked to fit into a building based on the parameter of the flow of traffic and things of that nature. So it's an instrument of design that you pay to use, but it's still the intellectual property of the architect. One thing that Jim did not mention is that the construction document that we create depends on the size of your project. It range between, including the engineer drawings and the architect drawing, could be 20 sheets to 50 sheets. And we're talking about sheets of drawings that we use will literally cover your desk. Okay, they're large drawings. So the construction document become a legal contract that you use on the project. It dictates what the contractor have to use to build around. Jim, could you explain a little bit in more detail of what the construction administration really involved? Because a lot of time I find that some of the clients go, well, you know, I got a contractor on board. I don't need the architect after we're done bidding the job.
Well, absolutely. And actually, we're going to have an episode on just that particular topic. But the construction administration is crucial because it's really our last line of defense. And I don't want to create an adversarial kind of situation, but in reality, it's our last chance for eyes and ears other than the contractor to look at something while it's under construction. Previous episodes, we've talked about how quickly things get built and how fast money gets spent. And if something's in error, how quickly you could result in change orders that would be extremely costly. So our construction administration phase, we do things, like I said, shop drawings. Shop drawings are the outline of the specific pieces and parts that are going to be placed in the building. We look at those. We approve those, both along with our engineers, to verify that actually what they're going to be utilizing and putting out there and how they're going to put it in the building is the proper way to do that. And then that's also what we utilize to look at when we do some observations to make sure that's in fact what they did do. So that it's a legal document that is used in your contract with your contractor. And this is the scope of what they are to build and what you're going to be paying for. But the construction administration is so crucial. We're also that sounding board to the contractor who maybe has a question. We'd much rather have them ask a question before they do something, then turn around and build a wall and say, is this wall in the right place? Well, if you asked a question before, it didn't cost you any money. But if you build the wall and then ask the question and you're wrong, then you've got to pay to tear the wall down and then rebuild it again. All of a sudden, you're spending thousands and thousands of dollars that need not be spent. The architect is there to be able to help facilitate the construction method and materials that the contractor is using. We're not in charge of methods and materials, the contractor is, but we're there to help facilitate. We're that second eyes and ears that's so crucial to being and setting up the builder so that he can succeed and thus so that the project can succeed. So when it's all said and done, the goal is to have minimal, if not zero, change orders on the job so you don't have to spend extra money that you didn't anticipate for, and you get a high quality finished product that's exactly what you thought you were going to get back when we were doing that very pretty picture conceptual designing side and thought, ooh, that's what I want to have as my front lobby. That's what I want to have as my front desk. That's what I want to have when my patient walks into the operatory and what they want to see when they look out that window. All that stuff has to come together at the end, and we're key to making sure that that happens. Without that, it's kind of like driving down the road at night without your lights on. Sure, you can do it, but you might run into something, and then it's costly. So with that, we're getting closer to the end of our show tonight. I wanted to quickly remind everyone that we've got a couple really interesting things coming up. On the 25th of September, we'll be having Dr. Bill Hunsinger as a guest co-host along with myself and Han. And that particular show is going to be about how many ops do I need? So that's the perfect time to ask the question from the guy who's been doing it for 30-plus years, more than I know Han and I have been at this. And he's the guy to be able to ask that question about. And then also on October 30th, we have Mike Montgomery from Live Oak Bank is going to be with us as another guest co-host. And that topic is going to be, who do I talk first, the contractor or the banker? And he'll be able to really fill you in on what the best way is to move forward with, from a lending financial side. With that, Hanna, just real quick, anything happening? What's the hottest thing that's going on in Dentaltown this week?
An interesting topic was posted by Dr. Howard Ferran of Dentaltown on the what's called the jet air hand dryer, or most of us would call it electric hand dryer, mainly particularly the one that blow your skin off of your hand when you put your hand underneath. Okay. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, right? Yeah.
They just did a study, and they come to the conclusion that the jet air hand dryer, there's a couple reasons why it's not used in a lot of small offices, mainly like in dentist office. Because one is because it's really noisy. Okay, that's mainly why you don't see that in small doctor offices and stuff.
And two,
you usually, besides that, okay. I mean, you know, roughly a couple of decades ago, the big discussion was the no touch, faucet and stuff like that. That sounds great, especially for the germophobic. Okay. The problem is, for the hand dryer anyway, you put your hand into the sink if you wash your hand, all right? It's really gross. I'd say this is gross because a lot of people don't wash their hands when they do their business. Because that way, don't shake anybody's hand when you meet them in public. But when they wash their hand, they say that people don't really wash their hand properly. And so they have germ and bacteria and all that stuff on their wet hand, and they stick it underneath this jet air dryer, and it blows it all over the place. So it basically spread the bacteria and the germ and all that. It become airborne and fill the room. It gets on them. It gets on everything. and then you get to take it and share it with the public. So they find that it has a less desirable outcome than what it has designed for, because it just one of those things that just blow everything. Now, when you say it doesn't work, yes, I have to agree with you. Is most of the time is that you got a dripping hand, you stick your hand underneath this, you know, this thing, and it's supposed to be hand-free sensor, and the sensor doesn't work. Now you got this puddle underneath the machine. So wherever that machine is installed, the biggest mess is not just on the floor; it's also on the wall. I think if you're into the green thing, you have to reconsider what else is available to use besides those things that, you know, besides the jet air or the electric hand dryer. But paper seems to do a much better job, much quicker job, and apparently a lot healthier job. That was interesting. I totally agree.
Very, very interesting. Well, with that, we obviously want to thank you for spending your time with us, and to all those listeners and the future listeners are going to listen to the podcast that will be available at our website. If you would like to learn more about us, you can obviously get a hold of Han or I at going to our website at www.hjtdesign.com, or feel free to give us a call on our 800 number, which is 1-866-213-1268. With that, we'd like to say good night. We look forward to next week's episode, which we're going to be in-depth discussion, I believe, having to do with construction costs. Oh, that'll be a fun one.
That will be a fun one. So,
without a doubt.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for tuning in. Until next time, have a good evening.
You've been listening to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk with Jim and Han. To contact us and find out more info about upcoming shows, please log on to our website at www.hjtdesign.com. Until next time.